Shall we get started? Good morning. Today's hearing will provide the subcommittee with an opportunity to learn firsthand about the efforts by the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs in assisting military service personnel transitioning from active military service to veteran status. One of my goals as chairman, and I might add it's probably the top goal of the committee, particularly the Oversight Committee at this time, is to ensure that these efforts are transparent to the service member, a concept generally referred to as seamless transition. Over the past several years, this subcommittee has aggressively pursued implementation of seamless transition. Past efforts have been met with mixed results. Let me be very clear. I intend to ensure that seamless transition becomes a reality. Time does fly up here, and we have our causes, and the regular routine stuff sometimes keeps us from meeting the goal that we've set for ourselves. But I hope that with the help of a great staff and with the work of minority Mr. Strickland and Mr. Reyes, we'll be able to do it. Our service personnel and their families deserve nothing less. Separating from military service can be a very stressful event. It's often filled with apprehension, trepidation, and a great deal of uncertainty. It's something that I experienced many, many years ago. This is especially true for personnel that are injured or disabled in the performance of their duty. And it's also true for the families of military personnel whose loved ones may have received severe injuries, like traumatic brain injury, spinal cord, or other debilitating injuries. We're all too familiar with stories in the national press about wounded service members falling through the crack in the process of transitioning from DOD with regards to health care and compensation and disability benefits. It's heartbreaking to see these young men and women with serious injuries left destitute at the most trying time of their young lives. So one of my first initiatives as chairman of this subcommittee was to conduct field oversight activities, and recently we completed field visits at the James A. Haley VA Medical Center in Tampa, Florida, and Walter Reed Army Medical Center. I was pleased with the initiatives by both the DOD and the VA and their efforts to achieve seamless transition. I look forward to hearing from the dedicated personnel that work hard every day behind the scenes to ensure that our nation's veterans receive the care that they deserve. And while I applaud the two agencies for their work, more can be done. Overall, the goal of a seamless transition is to educate service members about VA benefits and to provide the service member a single comprehensive medical examination that meets the requirements for DOD discharge physicals and VA's disability and compensation examination. And you would be surprised at the difficulty we're having getting that simple thing done. That should also extend to other VA programs such as the GI Bill and vocational rehabilitation. Ideally, service members who elect to file for disability and compensation would have a VA decision on their disability claim at the time of discharge. In cases of severe injuries and disabilities, seamless transition should encompass a continuity of care and benefits when transferring from one healthcare system to another. Today's hearing will focus on the timely transfer of service members from military hospitals to VA medical centers to review of the benefits delivery and discharge program and service-specific initiatives. The DOD and VA must get serious. They must get serious about working together to make this a reality, and this subcommittee stands ready to make that happen. And I now would like to recognize Mr. Reyes from Texas, who is ranking member today, and with whom it has really been a pleasure throughout the years to work on this committee.
Please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and likewise, it's been my privilege to work alongside you and all the other members of this committee to try to address issues that are so important to our veterans and those that are coming out of the military and will be taking advantage of the work that we do here in this committee. I apologize for running a little bit late, but as you know, Mr. Chairman, we've got conflicting hearings this morning. Mr. Strickland sends his apology, but last week when we were evacuated, that bottled up and doubled up a lot of the hearings, and we're all affected by that. In fact, I came here from one of the rare open hearings that we have in the intelligence community. Last night we worked on the Armed Services Authorization Bill until almost 1 o'clock. So those are the kinds of things that are going on here. So I know that I'll have to go back to my intelligence hearing, but I would ask, Mr. Chairman, if our counsel can ask questions since Mr. Strickland's not going
to
be able
to. Yes, that has been mentioned to me previously, and I understand that is allowed in this committee, and by all means, that certainly will be the case.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate that courtesy. I would also ask, Mr. Chairman, that complete statement be placed in the record, and I'll make some brief comments.
Yes, and without objection, the statement of all members of the subcommittee, whether they be here or not, can be made a part of the record. Please proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I would like to welcome all of those testifying. I would also like to specifically recognize those who have served in uniform for being here this morning. The issue of service members transitioning back to civilian life is a very important and sometimes very complicated one. It is not a new issue. America has a duty to assure that this transition is smooth and accessible to all who serve, as well as a duty to make each and every soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine who was injured or otherwise harmed while serving their country whole again. Our ongoing combat activities in Iraq and Afghanistan provide us with a constant stream of wounded and disabled GIs. This reality is not different from any past war of this country's history. Having said that, the injuries received in theater are sometimes different than in previous battles due to the ever-changing technology that's available for the protection of our troops, different protective equipment, and different modes of transportation that we see each and every day in both theaters. Not only must we adapt as necessary to treat those injured in a timely manner, we must create a system that will embrace all their needs. We justifiably proclaim our healthcare system as one of the best in the world. Its capacity to cure the sick and to restore the injured has very few rivals anywhere. But, Mr. Chairman, we do not always assure that those in need who have served in uniform benefit from the excellent system of healthcare. We need to remain vigilant to this. How well we are doing in terms of seamless transition, VA and DOD coordination on this effort is generally good, and for the average transitioning service member, that is a testament to their abilities. For the severely injured, the system is excellent, yet we are often reminded of instances where someone has fallen through the safety net. The Government Accountability Office observes that VA can utilize no system-wide official source of data on the returning service members, but achieves its results by targeting individual facilities. If information can be shared locally, why can't it be shared system-wide? Seems to be, to me, a simple enough system to be able to give us that kind of information. Each agency needs to accommodate the other in an environment free from any types of barriers. We also must remain conscious that not all battle injuries are visible. These individuals must be identified, engaged in a seamless transition, and receive treatment from a caring and adequately funded Veterans Administration. We also must maintain vigil for emerging problems. We must assure that when the transition to civilian life seems complete, the elements of that transition require monitoring and sometimes action to mitigate emerging service-related problems. We should learn from our past experiences and help these individuals complete the transition successfully and early. If we don't, the cost in both human and monetary terms will be much, much higher. With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for yielding me the time, and I yield back the balance.
Thank you, sir, and you certainly make very, very many, many good points there. There are no other members here, so I won't ask if any other members wish to speak. Hopefully, it's a small subcommittee. We only have, four or five members on it. We may have another one or two coming in one time or another. I'd like to recognize at this time our first panel. Ms. Cynthia Becerra is the Director of Healthcare, Veterans Health and Benefits Issues with the General Accounting Office. Ms. Brenda Foss is the Veterans Health Administration Social Worker, currently assigned to Walter Reed, and we met the other day. Ms. Linda Petty is a Veterans Benefits Administration Benefits Counselor, currently assigned to Walter Reed. We met the other day. And Major Lotta Tammy Duckworth, who is an Operation Iraqi Freedom veteran, currently receiving care at Walter Reed. And again, we met the other day. It's really wonderful to see you all here today. I'm going to ask you to limit your oral testimony, as per usual, of course, custom, to 5 minutes. Obviously, if you're on a roll on something significant, I'm not going to cut you off. But your complete written statement will be made a part of the record, so hopefully you will complement or supplement that. Being the case, we will start off with Ms. Becerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Reyes. We appreciate being here today to discuss GAO's work on the seamless transition. Today, I'd like to focus on VA's efforts to expedite vocational rehabilitation services to those seriously injured in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the related issue of its progress in developing a data-sharing agreement with DOD. As you know, more than 12,000 service members have been injured in combat since 2001, and a top priority is the continuity of their medical care between DOD and VA, as well as their smooth access to all other VA benefits should they decide to separate from the military. My comments today are based on a report we issued this January on VA's efforts to expedite voc rehab services. To do our work, we reviewed VA's formal and informal procedures and conducted interviews with officials at 12 of VA's regional offices. 5 of these offices were located near the military treatment facilities that provide medical care to the majority of seriously injured service members. We're also reporting on our ongoing review of VA and DOD efforts to develop a data sharing agreement that would comply with the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act's privacy rule, which governs the sharing of individually identifiable health data. We discussed the information contained in this statement with DOD and VA officials, who concurred with our findings. In September 2003, VA asked if its regional offices could learn the identities, medical conditions, and military status of seriously injured service members in their areas by coordinating with staffs at the MTFs. The regional offices were instructed to focus on service members who were definitely or likely to separate from the military and to assign case managers to them. VA underscored the importance of early intervention and the provision that allows VA to provide services even before discharge. Lack of systematic data from DOD, however, proved challenging. So in the spring of 2004, VA requested that DOD provide personal identifying data, medical data, and DOD's injury classification for service members. We found that in the absence of systematic data from DOD, the completeness and reliability of VA's data was dependent on the nature of their local relationships. For example, one regional office received from the MTF only the names of new patients, but no data on the severity of their medical conditions. In contrast, another regional office reported receiving lists of MTF patients with information on the severity of their injuries, as well as lists of service members for whom the Army had initiated a medical separation. We noted that in the absence of a data sharing agreement, VA cannot reliably identify all seriously injured service members or know with certainty when they're medically stable, when they may be undergoing evaluation for medical discharge, or when they have been discharged. As a result, VA cannot reasonably assure that some of these service members who may benefit from voc rehab have not been overlooked. To remedy this, we recommended that VA and DOD collaborate to reach an agreement for VA to have access to information that both agencies agree is needed to promote the service members' recovery and return to work in either the military or the civilian sector. However, DOD and VA have not yet developed a data sharing agreement, even though they've been discussing the issue for more than 2 years. We identified their different understandings of the HIPAA privacy rule as an impediment to their progress. Two examples illustrate the nature of their disagreement. First, the privacy rule permits government agencies providing public benefits to disclose individually identifiable health data to each other when the programs serve the same or similar populations. VA officials told us they believe DOD can share health data because the departments do serve the same or similar populations and both provide public benefits. On the other hand, the DOD official responsible for implementing the privacy rule contends that serving the same or similar populations would apply only to service members who are duly eligible for both DOD and VA services. He also said that the services provided by DOD are not public benefits because they are unlike the examples in the preamble to the privacy rule, which does not define public benefit. The second example involves the department's differing views regarding when in the separation process DOD could share health data with VA. DOD is reluctant to do so until it is certain that a service member will separate, while VA believes that DOD could share the data sooner. Mr. Chairman, VA and DOD are currently working on a memorandum of understanding that they tell us moves them closer to a data sharing agreement. Unfortunately, we found that the draft essentially restates many of the legal authorities already contained in the privacy rule. Consequently, VA and DOD will still have to resolve the details of what health data can be shared and when it can be shared. Until then, we believe that the transition of service members from DOD to VA for vocational rehabilitation and for other necessary services and benefits may not be as seamless as possible. That concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy to answer your questions.
Well, you know, when we inquired about DOD, and I think it would be a good idea to have the VA representative and the DOD representative sitting at the same table to try to explain to this why in the hell it takes 2 years to even get to the point where they're even close to an agreement. But so that will come, that may possibly at the next hearing. And you know, the unexpected consequences of our act sometimes when we came up with HIPAA, I'm not sure that God was on our shoulder. I think somebody else was probably on our shoulder, but it's really caused an awful lot of problems, obviously, in healthcare. Ms. Foss.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am privileged to appear before you today to discuss my role as a VA-DOD liaison for healthcare stationed at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. I am honored to serve the injured soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who are returning from theaters of combat and who may benefit from VA services. My role as one of two VA-DOD liaisons at Walter Reed involves partnering with the MTF staff, active duty service members, veterans, family members, and VA medical centers across the country to ensure seamless transition of care and services. Together with the Walter Reed Social Work staff and other interdisciplinary team members, we develop a treatment plan which I help to expedite within the VA healthcare system. I'm assigned full-time on-site at Walter Reed and meet face-to-face with patients and staff. I provide consultation to staff regarding the availability of healthcare, and I also educate service members and their families regarding VA healthcare benefits. When the MTF staff identifies a service member who will need VA healthcare, a referral is generated, which also includes medical records and a treatment plan. Referrals may involve service members who require medical care while on convalescent leave, who are being separated or retired from the military, and will need continuous medical care. Transfers of care may involve patient services such as acute rehabilitation for traumatic brain injury, spinal cord injury, visual impairment, loss of limb or function, as well as acute inpatient psychiatry. Outpatient services may include primary care, orthopedics, physical or occupational therapy, neurology, oncology, and mental health. An important part of the coordination of care involves meeting with the service member and the family to review this treatment plan and transfer plan. I pay particular attention to any special needs that the family member or service member may have. Once I have received the referral, the service member is enrolled in the VA healthcare system, and the transfer of care is coordinated with the OIF point of contact at the designated VA Medical Center. The point of contact arranges for outpatient appointments and or the inpatient admission. I then meet with the patient and the family member at Walter Reed to confirm the appointments being made, to provide them with the point of contact information, and to continue to address any issues or concerns they may have about the transition process. I remain available to answer any questions while they remain at Walter Reed before they are transferred. I also monitor the transfer through our computerized patient record system that the VA has So if a patient is being transferred, say, from here to California, I can monitor that transfer and actually look in the computer system and see did they actually attend their appointment or were they admitted properly. Due to the renowned amputee clinic at Walter Reed, we have a high volume of patients with amputations from all branches of the service. These patients will require long-term medical care and prosthetic care. I work closely with Walter Reed and the Washington, D.C. VA Medical Center to provide prosthetic equipment such as ultralight wheelchairs, collapsible canes and crutches, and hand cycles for cardiovascular exercise. I collaborate with Walter Reed Department of Physical Medicine and Rehab and the VA Maryland Healthcare System to schedule driving evaluations for patients with amputations, traumatic brain injuries, and visual impairments. I also communicate with the VA blind rehab specialist who visits the visually impaired patients at Walter Reed to provide education about VA blind rehab services. I also work with the Veterans Benefit Counselor and Vocational Rehab Educational Counselor from the Veterans Benefits Administration who are located at Walter Reed. We communicate on a daily basis to review the needs of the patients and how we can coordinate our services to support an optimum level of functioning and independence. Change provokes anxiety, and my goal as a VA DOD liaison is to help the OIF OEF veterans face their new lives with enthusiasm, hope, and optimism. The enhancement of coordinated services between DOD and VA promotes a positive transition from military to civilian life and ultimately has a lasting effect on our veterans, families, and community. I'm honored to serve those who have served our country. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my statement. I look forward to answering any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Voss. Ms. Petty, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, it is a privilege to appear before you today to discuss my role as the supervisor of Veterans Benefits Administration Outreach Team at Walter Reed. I retired from the United States Army in 2003 after 28 years of both active and reserve service. I am honored that VBA gave me the opportunity to work at Walter Reed, supporting these servicemen and women, our newest veterans. VBA detailed a full-time benefits counselor from the Washington Regional Office to Walter Reed Army Medical Center in August of 2003. I joined the Walter Reed staff in March 2004 as the supervisor. My role was to coordinate support requirements, develop administrative procedures, and provide a single point of contact for both the military and VA issues. We currently have 4 full-time permanent staff members at Walter Reed and 1 at Bethesda. We also have a contract vocational rehabilitation and employment counselor to provide early testing and evaluations. We strive to meet every injured service member returning from the theater of operations with special emphasis on those designated by the military as very seriously injured, or special category persons as soon as medically appropriate. From the beginning, we tried to schedule visits within 72 hours of the patient's arrival. This was an unrealistic and inappropriate goal. We found that few patients were physically or emotionally ready to discuss veterans' benefits that soon after arrival. We now attempt to see every inpatient as soon as medically possible. We receive referrals from the military social workers, from the case managers, from the VA social workers, and periodically we check with the ward nurses to see if there is anyone we need to visit. At the first visit, we introduce ourselves and gather some basic contact and personal information. We try to follow up every few days with a short visit to gauge when they are ready for more information or to start a claim. It is often weeks or even months before someone is ready to start a benefits claim. Our goal is to build a relationship based on the service member's needs. One of our unique aspects is our full-time vocational rehabilitation and education and employment counselor. This counselor provides vocational evaluation and testing, resume review, and employment referrals. We issue ergonomic computers and equipment as soon as eligibility is established. The VR&E program at Walter Reed also arranges volunteer employment opportunities so service members can get valuable civilian work experience prior to separation. The VR&E program gives both service members and their families reassurance that they do have employment options after separation. In July 2004, the clinic physicians invited VBA counselors to participate in their weekly outpatient amputee clinic. These meetings allow us to see patients we might otherwise have missed, to follow up with those who started a benefits claim, and to answer questions about the claims process. The VBA counselor at Bethesda attends similar interdisciplinary meetings. We work very closely with the VHA social workers and healthcare liaison. Often the VBA counselors have worked with a patient long before they are ready for referral to VHA. The VHA contacts us when they find a patient with benefits questions, and we do the same with healthcare questions. I periodically attend the Fisher House Family Support Group meetings to provide information on VA benefits available and the claims process. We prepare claims for compensation, automobile grants, loan guarantee, and adaptive housing, and voc rehab. We gather all available medical evidence needed to support the claims. Claims from both Bethesda and Walter Reed are processed from the Washington VA regional office. They process as much of the claim as possible before separation and finalize it upon receipt of proof of service. Our goal is to have the benefits waiting for the service member, not the service member waiting for benefits. Each VBA regional office also has an OIF coordinator and an alternate. We notify the coordinator when a patient leaves Walter Reed or Bethesda, even if it's just for a few weeks of convalescent leave. We tell the regional office how to contact the service member, what we have done to date, and let them know of any special needs they might have. The Undersecretary for Benefits established very specific guidelines for outreach and claims processing for all of these special category casualties. These claims are case managed and receive priority processing at the regional offices. The VBA regional services at Walter Reed and Bethesda are not limited to awaiting to those OIF service members. We counsel all other service members awaiting medical boards, provide transition services to include transition assistance program briefings and pre-retirement briefings. We also counsel retirees and surviving family members. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my statement. I look forward to answering any questions that you or the other committee members might have.
Thank you so much, Ms. Petty. And as time goes on, we're going to have questions from for all three of you, certainly. Getting to Major Duckworth. First, Major, I'd like to thank you for your extraordinary courage, your sense of duty, your desire to continue to serve your country. And it's just wonderful that you brought your mom with you here today. Ma'am, would you please rise so we can give you what you deserve, applause. Thank you, ma'am, for loaning Major Duckworth to her country. Major, your personal story of your tour of duty in OIF needs to be heard today. You can do so as briefly as you wish or whatever. And the story of your medical care in the military medical system, from the medevac helicopters, the combat support hospitals, Landstuhl Regional Medical Center in Germany, and finally here at Walter Reed, also needs to be told from your eyes. We also want to hear what you have seen and experienced during your rehabilitation at Walter Reed, specifically DOD's and VA's efforts to facilitate, educate, and aid you and your fellow heroes, the only true heroes, I might add, in our society, they and the law enforcement people and the fire people, in returning to duty or transitioning to the VA medical system and civilian life. And Major, I realize you're still in the service. I hope that you can share with us, you know, all the positives as well and also the negatives, and that your branch of service will allow you to do that, because our effort here is to not scold anybody or to hit anybody over the head. Our effort is to try to get things fixed, and so hopefully you can help us in that regard. The microphone is yours. I'm not even going to turn on the light, so you just take your time. Please proceed.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, Acting Ranking Member Reyes.
Mic a little closer. We want to make sure everybody can hear your comments.
It's stuck. I'll try to sit forward.
There we go.
Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Reyes, thank you for the opportunity to come before you today to discuss the care of wounded service members injured in operations Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom, and our efforts to facilitate the transition between the military, Department of Veteran Affairs, healthcare facilities, and between military and veteran status. On November 12, 2004, I was flying a mission in Baghdad. On my way back to home base at the end of the mission day, I was hit by an RPG, which amputated my legs in flight, came up through the floor of the aircraft, the window that's between the pilot's legs, which we use in order to land the aircraft and do close hover work. My pilot in command, the other pilot in the aircraft, successfully landed the aircraft. Chalk 2, which is the second aircraft in our flight, took all of the injured on board, transferred us to Taji, at which point I entered the military healthcare system, which was quite remarkable. The medevac aircraft, even though I had lost over 50% of the blood in my body and had been what my crew members thought was dead, they thought they were recovering a body, the medevac aircraft, which is a flying hospital of sorts, a flying trauma room, was able to actually revive me in the five-minute flight from Taji to Baghdad to the cache, and I actually was rolled into the cache, alert and talking. This is from being what people thought I was dead. At the hospital in Baghdad, they performed emergency amputations of the remainder of my right leg and cleaned up my left leg, at which point the doctors determined that I was probably going to become a triple amputee and lose my right arm also. So they very quickly transferred me to Landstuhl. I arrived after getting to Landstuhl. I stayed there for 16 hours. From Landstuhl, I was then sent right on to Walter Reed because of the very same fear that I would lose my right arm. I arrived in Walter Reed within 60 hours of my initial injury. I arrived at the cache in Baghdad within approximately 25 minutes from when I was hit. So due to the rapidness of this healthcare system and the funnel and the forward placement of surgeons in Baghdad and in Landstuhl, they were able to save my arm. I hope to have at least 75% recovery and use of my right arm, which is vital to me because I wish to stay in the military, serve in the National Guard, and continue to fly helicopters. So having my right arm is a major development for me, and I'm grateful. Every day that I see my surgeon who works on my arm, I thank him, and I tell him, thank you for my arm. So that's my background. I feel that a core component of the seamless transition is our nation's investment in its finest citizens, the past and present members of the military. I believe we must continue to fund and support the military treatment facilities. Military treatment facilities are a crucial part of the integrated medical system, which has performed so well during this conflict. In any previous conflict, I would not be alive. It is a testament to the superior protective equipment that I was wearing and to the medical care pipeline from the front lines that I can be here today. I would urge you to think of the efforts of the Army Medical Department and the VA as a force multiplier in two ways. First, these organizations can help us retain good soldiers, Marines, airmen, and sailors who would have otherwise not been able to continue to physically accomplish their missions and remain in the service of the United States. These wounded have already been trained at great expense, as well as been tested and gained invaluable experience in the crucible of combat. Second, our warriors must be able to focus completely and single-mindedly on the mission at hand, serving the people of the United States of America. When that mission is to close with and destroy our nation's enemies, I believe that we want our warriors to be secure in the knowledge that, when they are hurt, we will take care of them. As disabled soldiers transition to veteran status, we will look to the VA to provide continued access to health care, health technology, assisted living devices, and social services. The VA will have to face a challenge of providing care at the high level set by the military health care facilities. This is a challenge that the VA can meet if it is given enough resources and if it listens to the disabled service members and puts forth the effort to meet our needs. The first most easily identified need that the VA will have to support is continued access to technology, such as in prosthetics research. Disabled veterans will require access to evolving technology as they age and as the available technology undergoes innovation and changes. Second, as I look around at other wounded soldiers, it is clear that the majority of them are young with long lives ahead of them. Whether we will continue to have the honor of serving in uniform or return to productive civilian lives, we will require continued access to technology as we age. The VA will need to support this need over the long term, as currently wounded soldiers will be making use of its services over a lifetime. Third, disabled soldiers will need access to assisted living devices. Fourth, the VA will need to provide access to social services, such as job counseling and psychological support. Those that sustain brain injury, as well as those that develop psychological trauma, will need long-term counseling and support. Fifth, it does the disabled veteran no good if he or she is unable to access the various programs provided by the VA. For disabled veterans living in areas far from VA hospitals and facilities, travel itself is often a significant obstacle to their continued care. I can only hope and implore that the VA steps up to receive disabled veterans as we transition into its care from the military medical system. In order to do so, the VA will have to identify and develop specific programs, and those programs will have to be funded into the future. I also ask that a system such as a checklist be created to give to injured soldiers or their next of kin, to give them a roadmap to follow as they move from the military medical system into the VA. While I currently cannot comment from personal experience on the quality of care available in veterans' hospitals, I have been witness to the outreach efforts of the VA. These efforts have been highly personal, and as a result, my concept of the VA is not that of a faceless bureaucracy. At this point, the face of the VA is a veteran and amputee that befriended my husband and mother even as I lay unconscious in the intensive care unit. The VA is a former Army Ranger and his wife who came to visit me and all the other wounded in our hospital rooms. The VA is a vet who wheels in to check on the condition of my wheelchair and tells me from his personal experience the importance of a good seat cushion. I applaud the VA and the Department of Defense partnership that assists military service members who have served in combat and aims to provide them with a seamless transition to civilian life and veteran status. Those select individuals from amongst American people who would willingly serve in the armed services are a limited resource. Our warriors are expensive and indispensable. I believe we must jealously guard this resource, retaining as many as possible in the service and sparing little in the effort to return one of them to duty. The investment in training dollars represented by even one junior non-commissioned officer could easily be several hundred thousand dollars over the course of 5 to 6 years. Such are the expensive assets that the military treatment facilities is in the business of fixing and maintaining, and I believe the American people's tax dollars are well spent there. Additionally, once out of the military, our veterans make up a highly trained and disciplined pool of workers ready to add to the productivity of the civilian workforce. Veterans supported by the VA and able to lead productive lives are valuable contributors to our economy. The cost of providing wheelchairs and prosthetics to veterans through the VA system is an investment recouped through taxes paid by those same veterans who can now work as a result of these devices. Finally, on behalf of our injured, wounded, or ill service members and their families, I thank members of this great institution for this opportunity to address their concerns for medical care of our nation's veterans, soldiers, Marines, sailors, and airmen. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Major. Well, the chair recognizes himself, and the light can go on now. The light can go on. Was it a... Oh, she puts it on there. Ms. Becerra. Do you believe that DOD's concern regarding the HIPAA privacy rule provisions have merit?
That's a very important question. I think you mentioned in your opening statement that there might have been unintended consequences of HIPAA, and we understand why DOD takes this law very seriously. surely there's nothing more important than the privacy rights of individuals' health information. But it's hard for us to understand how in more than 2 years DOD could not figure out a HIPAA-compliant way to share data with VA, which is ultimately for the benefit of the service member. And if they couldn't do this on their own or they were fearful of being in violation of HIPAA, we believe that they could have and should have contacted HHS's Office of Civil Rights, who could have helped them by interpreting the HIPAA privacy rule, which is in their jurisdiction. So I guess the bottom line is that HIPAA certainly requires strict attention, and it might have even been an obstacle early on, but we don't believe it was an insurmountable one.
Do you think it should have taken as long as it has, a couple of years, to really not even reach? As I understand it, they were supposed to reach some sort of an agreement by today. I don't know whether that's just a coincidence that we're having the hearing today. But I'm not sure really what took place as far as that is concerned. But What do you think? Is there something more that the Congress should do in this regard? I mean, you know, we all realize that probably HIPAA is not perfect. Of course, it is the law. And we do appreciate DOD's problem that they want to abide by the law and they don't want to bear any undue risks or whatever the case may be. Should we be doing more in that regard? I mean, they haven't come up to us as far as I know. They may have gone to the Armed Services Committee, but as far as I know, they haven't come to the Veterans Committee and sat down with us and said, hey, these are changes or maybe clarifications we need, or what was the intent of the legislature, so to speak, et cetera.
We don't think at this point that there's a legislative fix that's required in HIPAA, certainly not without the department's asking for consultation from HHS on the matter. It would be premature to say that HIPAA is the problem or needs a legislative fix. And I guess I'd add that it could be that you'll have to legislate to tell DOD, to direct DOD to develop a HIPAA-compliant agreement to share data. But we think they can do it.
Did you do the, or were you involved in the regional visits to help determine whether the single medical physical thing was taking place?
Actually, another team did that work, but I'm familiar with it.
You're familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the statistics is, I don't recall the statistics, I guess. There's some 100 and some bases out there, and I think you told us, GAO told us that 12 of them weren't compliant or 8 of them weren't compliant or something like that. And then it was ultimately determined that I think only, one was up? Four were actually in compliant. In other words, so they were, sharing data, I guess, adequately so that the physical, that there was one physical that both groups, that both departments agreed with. Is that right?
Yes. I know, yeah,
please,
that you
please explain.
In
whatever it is you know in that regard, because it kind of blows my mind.
Right. I know that you're interested in this topic because it was mentioned in your in your invitation to the hearing. So I brought the report with me. And I don't have information on the accuracy of the number of BDD sites. There are either 139 or 140 or maybe even 144. But what we found in our report was that 20 military installations with BDD programs were supposed to have the single separation exam, which is a component of the BDD sites. And when we evaluated programs at 8 of the 28 installations who had the single separation exam, we found that actually 4 of the installations did not actually have the program in place. And I can provide for you the...
They didn't even know what BBD stood for, as I understand it. And they not only didn't have it in place.
I'm not sure about that. That's not that right. That language, that specific language isn't in this report. But for example, at one location, officials told us that a single separation exam was in place prior to our visit. But when they, when we got there, we discovered that it wasn't being followed and that the single separation exam wasn't even in operation. So. And there's documentation about that at the 4 locations. We also identified another military installation that had a single separation program, even though it wasn't included in their list. So there were errors of omission as well as other errors. So we're not confident in the numbers that we're getting from VA on that program.
Thank you very much, Ms. Pesetta. Mm-hmm. Mr. Reyes, to inquire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I regret that I'm going to have to leave after I ask this question, but I'm going to focus mostly on you, Major Duckworth. Just last night, we marked up the Armed Services budget. And next week, part of that bill, there's a provision there that we're trying to redefine the role of women in the military and in particular in combat. And it just strikes me that you are the perfect example. Your personal testimony and your personal courage and dedication to this country is exactly what I hope to talk about next week on the floor, because I in my district, regrettably, I've attended two funerals for two women that have been killed in Iraq. And it strikes me that when you talk about the spectacular care that you received and the ability to have you back here 60 hours, I believe you said, after you were injured. And I'm going to assume you're a Black Hawk helicopter pilot. The question that I have is the care that you have been provided, and by your own statement, the MTF's being spectacular. You also state that I do not believe that it can be duplicated at a civilian hospital at any price. And I guess my first question, Major, is it fair to say that some of your concerns may be based on medical expertise and some of your concerns are based on cultural needs of service members? In other words, there's a relationship there given the kind of care that is required after being traumatically injured in combat. 60 hours later, you're in the hands of military doctors that really know, understand, and empathize with your situation. Is that fair to say?
Yes, sir, it is exactly. First off, I'm a helicopter pilot because I chose the only combat arms branch that would allow women into combat, which is aviation. At the time when I was being commissioned, I requested aviation because I did not want to face fewer risks than this male soldiers. So that's how I became a helicopter pilot. My concern with transitioning away from the military treatment facilities are twofold, just as you have mentioned. First and foremost, these facilities have the expertise to deal with the very peculiar wounds that come out of combat. An example is I actually sat in on a training program for peer visitors just within the last couple of weeks where we talked with other amputees. And we actually spoke with a gentleman who has been dealing in prosthetics for about 25 years. He makes prosthetics legs. He was unfamiliar with a condition called HO that many of the soldiers who are amputees have. What it is, HO is when bone starts to grow into the tissue where a blast injury happens. Because this man had never dealt with anybody who had been an amputee as a result of a blast injury, he was not familiar with this condition, which is so pervasive amongst the population at Walter Reed that it's a matter of course that they understood what to do. I also believe that my arm probably would not have been saved if it had not been for the surgeons at Walter Reed, because they were very familiar with the effects of blast injuries and the shrapnel that I incurred. It's very different from losing your limbs from diabetes or losing your limbs in a car accident. That's my completely non-professional, non-medical opinion. The second issue is the cultural issue. The doctors at Walter Reed, where I'm personally being treated, many of the doctors and nurses have been in Baghdad. They were at the very same cache. They understood what it meant to have to wear the body armor. They understood what it means to have been the target of mortar and rocket attacks themselves, because that medical hospital is one of the main targets for the insurgents. So there is that cultural background that is a big help. Also, to be as a part of a population, a concentration of other amputees who have gone through the same thing that you've gone through, who are, just like yourself, generally healthy prior to undergoing this traumatic injury, is a source of encouragement for one another. I can sit in that room in the physical therapy lab as I'm learning to walk with the other soldiers, and we all know and understand what we've gone through. So it's not just the healthcare providers, but it's also being with other soldiers as well.
Thank you, Major. Mr. Chairman, can I follow up one question? When the transition is made and the service member's care comes under the VA, are those two same rationales that are of concern to you, are they still important in your opinion?
I think once I have transitioned to the VA system, sir, I've gone through the initial phases of recovery when those items are the most crucial. Having the other soldiers, having the military doctors. Once I've transitioned into the healthcare, the VA system, I believe that I will be much more able and more self-reliant than I am within the initial first months. For example, I received my first legs in January, just 2 months after I was injured. And I was able to see that that's something that I can do. I can learn to walk again because the other soldiers were doing it. I doubt that if I were by myself, one of maybe one or two amputees in a hospital someplace, that I would have actually been able to conceive of doing that. Whereas being at Walter Reed, where I saw people doing it all the time, it was, of course, you know, 2 months after having my legs blown off, I'm going to be walking again.
Well, thank you very much, Major, and thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your service, and you're an American hero. Thank you.
It's an honor to wear the uniform, sir.
Well, and you know, and they all feel that way. Here they are, you know, with a limb missing and just other problems, and they just feel that way. Major, do you have maybe sort of try to hitchhike a little bit on Mr. Reyes' question? Do you have any concerns that the expertise that you have experienced in the military facilities will not be there with the VA? I mean, do you have any concern in that regard? Do you expect the same sort of expertise that you've experienced?
In the initial stages, sir, I do. Just because of the volume of patients that come through initially. For example, there's been approximately over 250 amputees in this latest conflict, and they have generally been divided between, I believe, Brooks Army Medical Center and Walter Reed. If you distribute those amputees over all of the VA hospitals, you now have a population of two or three, perhaps, in each hospital across the 50 United States. So I would think that the expertise that are being gained by the physical therapists, for example, my personal physical therapist, she's seen 15 other blast injury amputees prior to this. But if she was working in a VA hospital in the initial months, I think that it is a significant factor. But again,
it would be something new to her and to that physical therapist.
Yes, sir. And she would see, not be able to pick up on some of the problems that I'm having because she would not have seen it in someone else, having seen maybe just two or three in her local VA hospital. However, I think once I've graduated from the military treatment system and have moved on to the next stage in my life, moved on to the VA system, then I don't think it's an issue once you make that transition. I just believe that in the beginning, this is my first 6 months right now, I think it's vital for me to be with other soldiers and be with a large enough population that the medical people providing medical care have seen that many people going through and understand their injuries.
In the follow-ups, Ms. Foss and Ms. Petty, in the follow-ups that you have, and I understand you've got that into effect at Walter Reed, I hope that's all over the system. Maybe we can find out about that as we go on. Have you run into this problem that we're talking about? In other words, that the resources in the VA may not be as adequate, mainly because of lack of experience, if you will, with certain conditions, et cetera?
Any time that I've, in my experience of transferring any patients, you know, I do pass along those medical records to the facility so they're aware of what injuries the patient has. To my experience, I haven't had any VA staff say that they could not manage the care. And as Major Duckworth mentioned, with some of the amputees, the bulk of their care is at the MTF, and then once they're recovered, then they're going on to the VA hospitals.
Mm-hmm. But no problems as far as you know?
To my experience, no. They have all been very receptive.
Mm-hmm. Brenda, anything that you want to add to that? I mean, Linda. Yeah, you did you want to add anything to that?
Yes.
Linda. Brenda, Linda. Okay. All right, Mr. Bradley to inquire.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for not being here for the earlier part of your testimony, but I have two questions for Ms. Fass. to what extent do you facilitate the sharing of medical information between Walter Reed Army Medical Center and the VA healthcare facilities where injured service personnel are being transferred?
I receive the medical records specific to the treatment that's being requested in the referral packet. We have a referral form, and when I get that information from the MTF staff, particularly usually the social worker, I receive the medical records at that time, and then I transfer them to the VA.
And secondly, in your written testimony, you stated that the DOD participated at times on the VA's Seamless Transition Task Force. Could you please explain that and what you mean by at times and what could be done to perhaps better facilitate that?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. That was a question for the GAO representative.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I can respond to that. In our January report on vocational rehabilitation, we characterized DOD's participation as ad hoc. In other words, the Seamless Transition Task Force was a unilateral initiative of VA. And it was actually formed in response to some negative media about certain veterans who were, in fact, falling through the cracks. DOD had some participation in the task force, but they weren't formal members. And, of course, we're aware that there are other avenues for DOD and VA to talk about seamless transition at the executive level through the Joint Executive Committee, the Health Executive Committee, and the Benefits Executive Committee.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Before I yield to Mr. Sistek to ask Mr. Strickland's questions, I would advise Ms. Duckworth, Major Duckworth, that as I understand it, VA, I guess, also has the same concerns that you have, and I failed to mention to you that as I understand it, there are four, VA has designated four what they call poly trauma centers. And I know that Haiti and Tampa is one of them in my area. So we're probably, hopefully, we're talking about the 250 not being spread that thin. In other words, four centers, then hopefully they will be able to handle things just to make you feel a little better. Certainly makes me feel a little better. Mr. Sistek, please proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to follow up on your very first question with GAO. Concerning HIPAA. Ms. Becetta, you stated that there's no system-wide sharing of information, but that information is shared due to the efforts of the regional offices in coordinating with the MTFs to gather data specific for that MTF to allow for an information exchange. So we have an information exchange working locally and seemingly producing some pretty good results, but there's nothing working system-wide. Does HIPAA distinguish between local informal agreements and system-wide agreements, and can the informal agreements already in place serve as a precedent to perhaps help DOD find its way through the HIPAA maze?
Well, I think that's a good point. I don't have the specifics on the local arrangements that have been worked out with regard to HIPAA. But, for example, some of them may have authorizations from service members to release information. Others may be less formal than that. But I'd point out that we found the need for the systematic data sharing because the local arrangements were not always very successful, and it did impede the ability of VA to provide early intervention and to be able to follow up with service members as they left the MTFs or the VA hospitals and went back to their homes. But I think your point about looking at some of those arrangements to see whether they could serve as models or as precedents is a good one.
Your testimony on page 3 mentions the Joint Executive Committee, and the Joint Executive Committee has produced a joint strategic plan in 2004, and there are a series of initiatives under that joint strategic plan that have milestones that have already passed, some of which include the sharing of best practices between the DOD and VA, performance measures for communications plan, defining GME and training needs, developing operational procedures. Do you know if these particular milestones have been met?
No, I don't. We haven't been tracking this in a way that I'm able to report on that today. We do have work that was mandated in the National Defense Authorization Act last year for us to look at sharing that goes on between VA and DOD, not the data sharing agreement that we're talking about today, but the broader resource sharing. And so we are following up and reviewing the communication at the executive levels.
Thank you very much. I believe information sharing is a major part of the joint strategic plan. So, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Sistek. Major and ladies, thank you so very much. You've been awfully helpful. We have a series of questions which, you know, we felt just wouldn't be enough time to ask them orally. So we will be furnishing them to you as per usual, and we would hope that you would respond in a timely fashion. Again, basically, you're dedicated folks. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing what you're doing. And so help us to sort of help you do your job better, where you would feel a lot better about your job, that things are the right things are being done. So anyhow, feel free to recommend to us, answer our questions. If you feel that there's any kind of a problem internally that prevents you from making a recommendation that you would like to make, well, obviously, we'd like to know about that. Not that I think that anything like that would happen. Thanks so very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we would ask maybe the second panel to come forward. Colonel Gwendolyn Fryer, United States Army, is the Southern Regional Medical Command Military Liaison to the James E. Haley Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Tampa, Florida. I've already welcomed her to Tampa. Colonel Timothy Frank, United States Marine Corps, is the liaison officer to the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Colonel Frank, thanks for being here, and thanks for taking on that chore. We probably will be spending a lot of time with you. Mr. John Brown is the director of the Office of Seamless Transition, Department of Veterans Affairs. Certainly, sir, we'll be spending a lot of time with you. And Ms. Linda Boone is the executive director of the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans. Okay, again, your written statement is a part of the record. We will turn the clock on to 5 minutes, and we would hope that you would sort of complement or supplement your statement, your written statement. Then I'll call on Colonel Fryer to start us off.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Congressman Bradley, distinguished committee members. I am Colonel Gwendolyn Fryer, and I, too, as the others, am very honored to appear before you today to discuss the new and evolving role of the Army Polytrauma Liaison. This role was established in March 2005 through the collaboration, the partnership, and collective wisdom of Lieutenant General Kevin Kiley, the Surgeon General of the United States Army, Dr. Jonathan Perlin, Undersecretary of Health for the VA, and the VA's Office of Seamless Transition. Today, I represent one of four Army Polytrauma Liaisons. We are strategically assigned to one of the four Department of Veterans Affairs Polytrauma Centers. I am assigned, of course, to the James A. Haley Veterans Hospital in Tampa, Florida, and my counterparts are assigned at either the Richmond, Virginia, Minneapolis, Minnesota, or Palo Alto, California centers. Although assigned in separate and distinct locations, the four of us agree that this role is extremely valuable as it directly and positively impacts the successful seamless transition of our injured service members and their families. In the initial establishment of this role, the partnership and collaboration efforts between the Department of Defense, represented by the staff of the Office of the Surgeon General, and Department of Veterans Affairs, represented by the staff of VA Office of Seamless Transition, were very obvious to the four of us. These two organizations spoke with one voice as they provided the necessary training to the four liaisons and ensured we understood that we were to, number one, manage and care for all active duty inpatient service members, regardless of branch of service or components, but those specifically assigned to the traumatic brain injury or spinal cord injury units of our specific facilities. And number two, to care for the whole family, not just the service members. In addition, OTSG and the VA Office of Seamless Transition ensured the development of a framework for success, as I've termed it. This framework involved the designation and utilization of VA employees to serve as an internal VA mentor and external program manager through which the polytrauma liaisons could themselves have a smooth transition into the VA system and between the DOD VA leaderships. Since arrival at the Tampa VA, I have been able to further develop and expand my role of polytrauma liaison officer in this same atmosphere of collaboration and partnership with the VA leadership and subordinate staff, the service members and their families, the interdisciplinary clinical staff, volunteer service organizations, regional and local agencies, and, of course, the line leadership of the service members' parent unit. Each of these groups represents sources through which key administrative, clinical, or care management issues of the service member or family member can be resolved. And likewise, they represent the multifaceted functions I am involved in on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis as this role continues to evolve, develop, and mature. Over the past 5 weeks, I have been embraced as a key member of the Tampa VA's leadership and healthcare teams, allowing me to work closely with OEF, OIF transition teams and committees, attend Haley House, equivalent to the Fisher House, committee meetings, gain access to patient database systems, attend selected nursing meetings, assist in facilitating Purple Heart award ceremonies and retirement ceremonies, and of course, facilitate resolutions for the military issues that impact the quality of life of the service member and family, such as pay, travel, transportation, distribution of household goods, legal assistance, and board actions. Clearly, this role has made a difference. As the green suitor in the facility, I am the boots on the ground, real-time, real-life helper, and voice for the service members and their families. I am their advocate and serve to remind others involved in their care that the service members volunteer to serve the nation, but this transition is unplanned and represents a psychological transition which is over and above the physical trauma. 30 years as a registered professional nurse, 24 years on active duty, this role has clearly been the most rewarding and fulfilling role of my career. It is my honor to serve those service members and their families. And so, Mr. Chairman, this concludes my statement, and I am happy to respond to any questions you or other committee members may have.
Thank you very much, Colonel Fryer. Colonel Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have to pull that closer, I guess, because...
Can you hear me now?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Congressman Bradley, and distinguished members of the subcommittee.
Oh, he left. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and distinguished members of the subcommittee. I appreciate this opportunity to present to you today my perspective on how we can best support our wounded warriors and their families as they transition from military hospitals to VA medical centers, and for many, ultimately, from an active duty to a veteran status. As I reflected on the issue of seamless transition, I drew from my 23 years of experience in both the active and reserve components and my assignment as the officer in charge of Marine Casualty Services at the National Naval Medical Center, where our Marines and sailors are provided their acute casualty care. The Marine Corps continues to be highly focused on caring for our injured Marines and sailors and ensuring that their family members are provided for and comforted in the wake of their injury. Supporting injured Marines and their families is a complex task, as their specific needs vary from case to case. We do our best to tailor our support to fit their individual needs and those of their families, showing flexibility whenever and wherever possible. The Marine Corps continuously evaluates its processes and makes adjustments where necessary to ensure that the appropriate level of support is provided. While we have encountered problems, we are actively collecting lessons learned and incorporating needed changes. I would like to make 5 key points. First, thanks to significantly advanced medical capabilities, the survival rate for our seriously wounded Marines and sailors has seen a dramatic increase. They are, however, returning with severe, debilitating injuries, much more so than in past conflicts. The complexity of these injuries, coupled with the individualized nature of recovery, has required a more comprehensive, multidisciplinary program of casualty care. As we support and care for these Marines and their families, we've learned from experience that we must remain flexible and be ready to adapt to an ever-changing situation. Secondly, military treatment facilities are not resourced to provide the specialized care for our service members who sustain spinal cord injuries, traumatic brain injuries, and loss of sight. The VA is known for its integrated system of health care for these conditions. Therefore, we rely on them to provide continued care and rehabilitation for our wounded Marines and sailors who have progressed from the acute care stage. The magnitude of these injuries and the lengthy rehabilitation and recovery period involved have not only taxed the military treatment facility, but the VA healthcare system as well. Both military medicine and the VA will have to continue implementing new programs and initiatives as they strive to broaden coordination of care and family support. My third point is that the quality casualty care requires extensive planning and coordination, which begins upon arrival at the MTF, through transition to the VA Medical Center, and continues even after discharge. Over the course of time, a positive and very cooperative relationship has been forged between the military treatment facility, the Marine Corps, and the VA, with significant progress made toward achieving a seamless continuum of care. We are all working together and remain committed to keeping the treatment, recovery, and transition of our injured service members as our highest priority. My fourth point is that the Marine Corps realized that the injuries our Marines and sailors received would have a significant impact on them for the rest of their lives, and that they and their families would need support and assistance long after they left the military treatment facility. The Marine for Life Injured Support Program provides continuity of support for our wounded as they continue with their recovery, make their transition to the Department of Veterans Affairs, and reconnect to their communities. Together with DOD's Military Severely Injured Joint Support Operations Center, Marine for Life Injured Support will bridge any gaps and provide around-the-clock advocacy and assistance. And finally, the recovery and successful transition of our wounded is not the responsibility of any single organization. It is a partnership between the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs. The assignment of two Marines at the VA Central Office was a collaborative decision between the Commandant of the Marine Corps, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and the Director of the Office of Seamless Transition. As one of those officers, I bring experience in casualty care and support, in addition to a background in both personal and family readiness, and hope to be a valuable asset to the dynamic, dedicated, and professional seamless transition team under the direction of Mr. John Brown. In conclusion, I consider it a very precious privilege to serve the many brave Marines and sailors who have given so much in the service of our great nation, and I look forward to continuing this support from within the VA's Office of Seamless Transition. Mr. Chairman, I look forward to answering any questions that you or the other committee members might have.
Thank you so very much, Colonel Frank. Mr. Brown, please proceed, sir. You have a big job.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of the subcommittee, I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you to discuss VA's efforts toward effecting a seamless transition for separating service members from the DOD to the VA. I retired from the U.S. Army in 2002 after 26 years of service. I am proud and honored to serve as the director of the Seamless Transition Office. Mr. Chairman, VA has no higher calling, no more important mission than to provide the best health care and benefits to our nation's combat veterans. We will honor these heroes and their families by providing them with the compassion and the dignity that they have earned. In August of 2003, VA created the task force for the seamless transition of returning service members. This task force focused on the internal coordination efforts to ensure that VA approached the seamless transition mission in a comprehensive manner. In January of this year, VA established a permanent seamless transition office to assume the duties of the task force. The seamless transition office reports to the Deputy Undersecretary for Health. It is composed of representatives from across the entire department. It is a one VA endeavor. The Seamless Transition Task Force and the Seamless Transition Office have achieved many successes. These include outreach and communications, trending workload, data collection, and staff education. VA has put into place a number of strategies, policies, and programs to provide timely services to these returning service members and veterans. And throughout the process, we have greatly improved dialogue and collaboration between VA and DOD. Today, VA is reaching out to all new combat veterans in unprecedented ways. Since fiscal year 2002, we have spoken to more than 700,000 active duty and National Guard Reserve members in discharge planning and orientation sessions. Secretary Principe and Secretary Nicholson have sent more than 290,000 thank you letters with information brochures to each OEF/OIF veteran identified by DOD as having left active duty. And we have prepared videos, wallet cards, and websites to ensure that they are all aware of their eligibility for VA health care. Each VA medical center has identified a point of contact to coordinate activities locally and to assure that no person is left during or lost during transition. VA has also assigned full-time social workers and benefit counselors to 7 military treatment facilities to facilitate immediate, comprehensive, and compassionate care and family support. VA social workers have coordinated more than 2,000 transfers of OEF/OIF service members and veterans to VA medical facilities, and VBA benefit counselors have interviewed almost 5,000 OEF service members hospitalized at medical treatment facilities. To ensure that our commitment is understood and shared at every level of the department, we have developed training materials and other tools for our frontline staff to assist them in identifying combat veterans so that they take the steps necessary to provide all veterans appropriate access to VA services and benefits. Although the Seamless Transition Initiative was created to support service members who serve in OEF/OIF, it is intended to become an enduring process. Therefore, VA is working with DOD to obtain a list of service members who enter the Physical Evaluation Board process. The list will enable VA to contact these service members and initiate benefit applications and transfer of health care to VA prior to discharge from the military. VA is strengthening its support for the veterans and their families to accommodate them in Fisher houses and hotels as the veterans continue the rehabilitation process. Finally, the Seamless Transition Office will guide VA's activities in meeting the expectations of our newest veterans and their families. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my statement. I will be happy to respond to any questions that you or other members of the committee might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. Ms. Spoone.
Thank you. The VA estimates that approximately 250,000 veterans are homeless on any given night. More than 500,000 experience homelessness over the course of a year. Male veterans are twice as likely to become homeless as their non-veteran counterparts, and female veterans are 4 times as likely to become homeless as their non-veteran counterparts. Like their non-veteran counterparts, veterans are at high risk of homelessness due to extremely low or no income, dismal living conditions, and a lack of access to health care. In addition to these shared factors, a large number of at-risk veterans live with post-traumatic stress disorders and addictions acquired during or aggravated by their military service. In addition, their family and social networks are fractured due to lengthy periods away from their communities. These problems are directly traceable to their experience in the military service or to their return to civilian life without appropriate transitional supports. Take Sergeant Vanessa Turner. She was deployed to Iraq, and while serving in combat theater, she collapsed, fell into a coma, and nearly died of heart failure. She was evacuated to Europe, then to Walter Reed, and released with a pending medical discharge. And that is the good part of Ms. Turner's story. Ms. Turner was released from Walter Reed with neither a place to live nor ongoing health care in place. Without a home, she and her daughter bounced from place to place. When she went to the VA Medical Center, she was told she had to wait 3 months to see a doctor. When she asked the Army to ship her possessions from her unit base in Germany where she had lived, they told her that she had to fly back on her own expense to get them for herself. And when she sought help to secure a veteran's loan for a house in Boston, she was told the only real option was to move to another part of the state. Ms. Turner's situation was partially resolved only by the persistent intervention of a member of Congress. Regrettably, there are dozens of more Vanessa Turners returning from Iraq and Afghanistan without a place to call home. The community-based homeless veteran service providers that National Coalition for Homeless Veterans represents are reporting service members from OEF and OIF among their service users. Some of these newly homeless veterans are seriously injured. Others are fighting PTSD and other emotional and addictive impairments. Still others simply have been unable to find work. Regardless of the cause, in a country as wealthy as the United States with the best military personnel and veteran support systems in the world, it is simply outrageous that any service member or former service member become homeless. NCHV is generally supportive of the various federal government-wide joint service and service-specific initiatives underway to assist severely injured service members in transitioning to civilian life. We are interested in knowing, however, what these various initiatives are doing to support seriously injured service members and the families facing a housing crisis. What housing counseling assistance does each initiative presently provide? How are seriously injured service members at imminent risk of homelessness assisted in securing permanent housing in the communities from which they will be returning? Have any of the services succeeded in involving the Department of Housing and Urban Development in their efforts? What connections are these initiatives making with local public housing authorities or nonprofit housing providers? Is housing even on the radar of these various initiatives? As this committee is well aware of, information and resource sharing between DOD and VA, while improving in recent years, remains a challenge for the two departments, resulting in redundancy, inefficiency, higher costs, and ultimately less than excellent health care for both our nation's service members and veterans. In 2001, President Bush established the President's Task Force to Improve Health Care for our nation's veterans and charged it to identify ways to improve health care delivery to DOD and VA beneficiaries. The task force released its report in 2003. Regrettably, DOD and VA have made slow progress on several of the task force recommendations, including some that are directly applicable to a seamless health care transition. Service members separating from the armed services have available to them two transition services programs, pre-separation counseling and the transition assistance program. Former service members with whom homeless veteran service providers are in daily contact report that pre-separation counseling and transition assistance programs are lacking in a number of areas. Among their concerns, the depth and the content of pre-separation counseling is quite variable across the delivery sites. Pre-separation counseling may be limited to brief group-level presentations rather than individualized transition planning. Service member participation in the transition assistance program is at the will of the unit commander and often allowed only during off-duty time. Neither program includes content on homelessness awareness or housing counseling assistance and referral. Weaknesses in both the content and delivery of the service member separation program results in many service members failing to receive information necessary to ensure their stable health care and steady employment and secure housing upon their return to civilian life. This places service members at risk of homelessness. In response to these concerns, Representative Andrews has introduced H.R. 2074, the Service Members Enhanced Transition Services Act, to improve transition assistance. We urge this committee's members to co-sponsor H.R. 2074 and to share its enactment this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Boone. The chair yields time to himself. Colonel Frank, Mr. Brown, Colonel Fryer, if you wish. Response to Ms. Spoon. She asked an awful lot of questions she wanted answers to, and that's I don't blame her. So responses. Maybe I'm catching you by surprise here, but
yes, sir. The testimony did too.
Yeah.
But this is a very serious area. I think that America has to look at. I was unaware of all of the questions and concerns that are in your testimony. I know we do have a homeless problem in America today. I would like to review your testimony, ma'am, and look at all of the questions that you have asked, and then reply for the record, sir.
Yeah, in the process of your function as Director of Seamless Transition for the VA, homelessness is a part of that. I mean, you know, the concern for homelessness. In other words, the follow through thing that Colonel Franks explained so very well, and that I saw Walter Reed includes homelessness, not just health care and some of the other things. But
the entire process includes homelessness. Uh-huh. But what I have been charged to do within the first 4 months my tenure is to build this office, to put people in there, and my first objective was not to let anyone fall through the crack.
Yeah, you've been there for 4 months?
Yes, sir.
Oh, boy.
In the position on 3 January.
Well, I said you have a tough job, but it's even tougher if you've only been there for 4 months.
So. Yes, sir. So the primary objective good. Right there was to make sure that as I transitioned from the task force initiatives, that I use resources from the task force as I built the office. Mm-hmm. And
I'm glad then you're able to hear this testimony, so that,
yes,
that could be a factor in your building.
I would like to look at your concerns, ma'am, in detail.
Yeah, I know Colonel Frank was really looking at you with great earnestness in your comments. Go ahead, ma'am.
I would just like to comment on the transition assistance program. Now, I know in the Marine Corps, that's a mandatory program, and there is pre-separation counseling, and there is a transition assistance workshop, both which are required for any service member who completes 180 days of continuous active duty. It was at one time a requirement for reserves who were mobilized. However, that is now mandatory. Precep counseling is still a requirement and certainly a leadership responsibility to make sure that that happens for our mobilized Marines. Transition assistance workshop is to be made available to them should they want to take it. I used to do some personal and family readiness programs, and I think the Marine Corps, I can speak for the Marine Corps only, a pretty strong transition assistance program. She was correct, and it is group. It's a group session. However, there is a transition assistance program manager with a staff who at any time a Marine or anybody, a sailor attached to the Marine unit, seeks out specific transition assistance, guidance, and perhaps help with direction on developing a personal plan for their transition. There is someone there to help them. A lot of our Marines, unfortunately, think that the transition is going to be easier than it turns out to be, and I think that they don't look ahead. But the resources and the support mechanism is in place for them to address those issues. The Marine Corps also has the Marine for Life program, which the Marine for Life Injured Support Program has kind of piggybacked off of, and that is a transition program. And General Jones instituted that program specifically to give our Marines a better transition and to ensure that those Marines who honorably wore the Eagle, Globe, and Anchor were able to meld back into their communities with jobs, with a reconnect to their community resources. And it covers almost any topic or subject you can imagine. So I feel like that Marine Corps-wise anyway, that we have good transition assistance programs in place. And maybe a lot of it is there's more there than maybe the Marines are aware of, and again, that's something that we can work to rectify.
Yeah, what a great slogan, Marine for Life. I know every Marine considers themselves a Marine regardless. I know I found that to be true in the veterans' posts and whatnot. But I believe that the Corps seriously takes that and is dedicated to the slogan. Now, it's not just a slogan, it's something that they live.
Absolutely. It becomes ingrained in your heart from the moment you put on that Eagle, Globe.
Colonel Fryer, did you want to add anything?
Sir, I'm simply going to add that I ditto what Colonel Frank has said. In fact, programs like that are set up for us service members in the Army. However, because the area of discussion is not in my area of expertise, I will take it for the record.
Sure. And I know you've just recently arrived in Tampa and whatnot. There is a homeless problem down there. I'm aware of that. Mr. Brown. Do you care to comment? My emphasis, of course, is seamless transition. But my major part of that, of course, is this one physical, this one joint physical, if you will, that both DOD and VA agree to. Four out of approximately 140 military installations, four of those have BDD into effect, apparently, something to that effect. Would you care to comment?
Yes, sir.
We're not here to throw against stones at DOD, as I said earlier. Whatnot. They have a tough job, particularly these days. There's no question about that. But your job, you seem to be dedicated to it. But you need cooperation. Are you getting adequate cooperation? Comment, please.
Well, sir, I am not the expert on benefits delivery at discharge. But I do believe it's a good program. We do have 140 sites that are able to process our physicals. We have 53 MOUs to date that have been signed between VA and DOD. We have another 80 MOUs that are in the process of being signed and should be signed in the near future.
What does that mean, MOUs?
MOUs that between VA and DOD facilities on who's going to actually perform them.
The physical and whatnot?
The physicals and so forth.
I see. Well, now, so you have those signed, but they're not in effect yet? Are they in the real world, or is this taking place in more than four facilities? Yeah, that's what I mean. 140, sure. GAO targeted 20, looked at eight of them and discovered that four out of the eight did not even know what BDD stood for.
Yes, sir. As I said, sir, at my opening comments, I am not the resident expert on this.
Yeah.
But generically, I know exactly what has been done overall.
Yeah, but see, you know, that's a very important part of seamless transition, is it not?
Yes, sir.
As far as they're applying for their benefits and all that stuff.
It supports the seamless transition process, yes.
Well, all right. We need your help. We need your help in terms of getting these things done. And we'll be talking to the Armed Services Committee. I guess, is that what we still call them, isn't it, Armed Services? Yeah. We'll be talking to the Armed Services Committee about this and maybe meet with them and possibly have a joint hearing. I don't know. I've mentioned that to them before. I would yield to Mr. Sistek.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. One very quick question for Ms. Boone. Focusing on recently separated discharged service members, why do they become homeless? What are the root causes? You've had experience with your organization since basically 1990. What emerges as the, quote, root cause of them becoming homeless recently after separating?
For this current war veterans, we think it's sort of one is that they don't have the information when they're leaving. Their separation process is flawed. The pre-separation counseling process is flawed. The TAP programs are flawed in the fact that they are not really being done consistently across the board. They're not TAP programs are not mandatory except for the Marine Corps. The pre-separation counseling, people can opt out of it. The checkoff list that DOD uses lets people opt out of it, which was not the intent of the law. And the other thing, the veterans that we have interacted with, our community-based providers are working with, the majority of them are looking for employment. And that ends up being, you know, a very basic necessity in order to have housing and to have all those other things is that you need income. It's about economics, and they need jobs. And they're coming to them because they don't have the transferable skills. Many of them also have issues around health, post-traumatic stress disorder, and we're starting to see substance abuse also as an issue.
Thank you, Ms. Boone. No further questions.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. There's so much more here. We have an awful lot of questions, and we're going to submit them to you in writing. I would ask you, Colonel Frank, for instance, you've in your written testimony, you've talked about encountering problems and addressing the needs that Marines have in an effort to achieve seamless transition and whatnot. So we're talking about experience that you're having with your Marines. We need that information from you. I understand you've collecting data and collecting lessons learned from and that sort of thing. This can be very helpful to us. And hopefully, of course, you're also working with Mr. Brown as far as those areas are concerned. But that's really what we need. There are problems out there, and no matter what we do, I mean, bigness usually connotes lack of perfection, so nothing's going to be perfect. But we ought to be a little better, doing a lot better than we are doing. And when you know that the BDD concept of the one physical that's agreed upon between the two, so that a person in the military who's about to be discharged is basically all of the paperwork has been, the physical and the paperwork has all been taken
care of before almost they're even discharged to start their benefit thing rolling. The big backlog that we now have would be cut down drastically and whatnot. And it makes sense to concentrate on areas like that. And that's why we raise these points. And I know bureaucracy and everything of that nature, heck, I've had 23 years of it. And it's horrible. But I guess what I'm saying is we can do better. And we should do better. And you can help us.
Yes,
so please respond to the questions we submit to you. But also don't hesitate to make any recommendations to us, share with us some of the things you're running into and whatnot, so we can do a better job. If there isn't anything further, we'll excuse you and declare this hearing over and hope that we can see better things resulting from it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.